This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
China will train its troops on the other side of the world, 94 miles from Florida. Technology built by Europeans is heading toward Iran without permission. More European militaries are combining into multinational forces. Why perverted justice is a threat to national security. And would Britain go to war for the Falklands again? Could it? All this and more coming up on Trumpet Hour.
Hello, I'm Philip Nice. Welcome to Trumpet Hour this Friday, June 23rd, 2023. You may be hearing us for the first time, or you may be one of our listeners who has made Trumpet Hour part of your weekly routine. And if you are, we thank you. We are happy to be back with you this week. We Philadelphia Trumpet staff members, I have here in the studio Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And in our studio, in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And in Jerusalem, Mihailo Zekic.
Good to be here.
Each week we cover four major regions of the world, and this week we're going to start with the Asia region. Jeremiah Jacques, what are some of the top stories from the Asia region?
Yeah, one big one is that Russia's military is still obtaining huge quantities of Western components that it uses in its weapon systems to attack Ukrainians. These components come mainly from the United States, and there are, of course, sanctions in place that are supposed to be blocking the Russians from ever getting their hands on these kinds of components. But new evidence this week shows that China has stepped in as kind of a middleman. China purchases these dual-use components from American and other Western companies and then sells them to Russian shell companies. And from there, they are exported to Russia, where they make their way onto the battlefield. So Russia is evading export controls and sanctions, and it's doing so with a huge amount of help from China. Another story here is that China is extremely upset that U.S. President Joe Biden called Xi Jinping a dictator. So this was, of course, very unfair to this kind man in Beijing, who we know as a humble, wise, avuncular figure who has only the best interests of all mankind in his benevolent heart, and who always runs free and fair elections to ensure that, you know, the will of the people is done. Just a bit of sarcasm there, because, of course, Xi Jinping actually styles himself after the world's most murderous dictator, Mao Zedong. And Xi has made himself the chairman of everything in China. It's a one-party state with zero chance for the will of the people to be done. So when you look at all of that, and when you look at Xi's unchallenged dominance over the Chinese Communist Party and over China in general, and just his ruthlessness, you see that, if anything, the label dictator is an understatement. Nevertheless, this statement by Biden came shortly after he sent the U.S. Secretary of State to meet with Xi Jinping to try to ease tensions between the two countries. And Biden's statement is kind of throwing cold water on those efforts. So whether it's accurate or not, Xi Jinping is fuming, and this statement was counterproductive. Another story here from Russia. Just yesterday, the defense minister Sergei Shoigu said that by the end of this month, Russia's reserve army will be completed. He said 114,000 people have already signed contracts so far to fight. Another 50,000 volunteers have also joined. So it's just more evidence that Russia's war could go on for a long time. And then, speaking of the war, there was new evidence this week of the way the Russians are treating their prisoners of war. And it's really sick to the core. The Russians are castrating some Ukrainian POWs and torturing many of them by all kinds of deranged methods. There was a new interview this week with a medical specialist who works with injured Ukrainian POWs. And she said that she examined some of these men and heard their stories. And then she said, quote, "I'd never heard anything so horrible. I told these men that I needed the bathroom and went and cried and cried. I didn't want them to see, as they might think there's no hope." So, you know, just a small glimpse right there into the sheer evil of the Putin regime and its enforcers. And it helps us, I think, to see why the Ukrainians are determined not to be ruled by that regime.
I thank you for bringing that to us, because it's we've talked about before, both on the show and off, the just looking back in history at something like World War II or the Holocaust or something like that, and how easy it is to think, well, if we had lived in that day, if such atrocities were going on, we would not have allowed such a thing as a nation or what have you. But the atrocities are going on in this world right now. We have to be aware of it, and as uncomfortable as it is to hear about, I think that's an important thing to be reminded of week to week as it happens. Back to China, though, for your main story and what they're doing on the other side of the world, America's side of the world.
Yes. Yeah, Chinese and Cuban officials are planning to build a joint military training base on Cuba's northern coast. This story was broken by the Wall Street Journal on June 20th, and it was based on testimony from U.S. officials who are familiar with all kinds of classified American intelligence. And they said that the discussions for the base are at a, quote, advanced stage. So, you know, the building hasn't yet started, but it's apparently nearing that point. And we know that when China sets its hand to a project like this, it generally doesn't take very long for it to materialize. And this this new report about this military base on Cuba, it comes just 10 days, I think it is, after the U.S. government declassified some documents revealing that China has already had operational spy bases in Cuba for several years now. So the Chinese have long had eyes and ears on the island, which lets them kind of listen in on electronic communications throughout at least the southeastern United States. And now they could very soon have this military training base in Cuba as well.
So there's these plans for this base. We've talked about China militarizing islands. Now they're militarizing Cuba to a degree with these plans for this base. And then you say other operations, spy operations that are already taking place. China already spying on the southeastern United States communications. Is this part of an even larger project, would you say?
It is, yes. Both the extant spy station on Cuba and the planned military training facility are part of what's being called Project 141. This is an initiative by the Chinese military to build really just a globe-girdling network of military bases and logistics hubs. China already has an operational base on the Horn of Africa, and they're working to open a military facility in the United Arab Emirates. There are also plans in place for a naval base in Cambodia right now. So Project 141, it's a very ambitious initiative. The Chinese know that America has about 800 overseas bases around the world in 80 different countries. Many of these American bases are just incomprehensibly powerful. In some cases, they're individually as powerful as many other nations' entire military force. So the Chinese, with Project 141, they're hoping to kind of catch up to the U.S. a little bit, or at least close the gap a little bit there. And Cuba would be a major step toward that goal, especially when you consider the proximity of, you know, the island to the American mainland. So that that Cuban base would really signify a new phase in the tensions and the rivalry between America and the U.S.
Very little is known about these facilities in Cuba as of now. It's not even clear whether a deal has been struck. Well, if and when that happens, it would signal a new chapter in this rivalry, a more dangerous chapter. Until now, China only projected power in the South China Sea. Beyond that, their capabilities were in doubt, untested. But recent events make you wonder, what's going on?
That was the journalist Palki Sharma there. I think the point that she makes is compelling about what this would mean for China's ability to just project power in the Western Hemisphere. So, you know, we don't yet know what kind of training will happen in this facility or when it'll be operational, but it definitely raises some very serious concerns for the United States.
So Cuba, as an island there in the Caribbean, functions as what the Trump calls a sea gate. That's why I believe you've brought this to us, is its importance as a sea gate. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that functions?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, this Chinese base in Cuba, it really does present serious dangers to the U.S. economy, because the island of Cuba, you know, it's a big part of what commands access to the Gulf of Mexico and all the important shipping lanes in the region that America depends on for its imports and exports. I've got a quote here from Geopolitical Futures founder and Stratfor founder, George Friedman. He warned that China's deepening influence in Cuba, it basically means that the Chinese could potentially block American ports without actually blocking them. He wrote, "The choke points are the waters between Cuba and the Yucatan Peninsula and between Cuba and Florida. The port of New Orleans and the port of Houston depend on these two outlets to ship and receive critical commodities for the U.S. From Cuba, a long-term threat could be maintained. It is an ideal place from which to manage the U.S." End quote. So that's just a chilling bit of insight there. And we've also got a clip here from geostrategist Peter Zion that gives a little more insight into this.
Now, Cuba will always figure hot and heavy in American strategic planning because it controls the Straits of Florida and the Yucatan Straits, which command access to the Gulf of Mexico. And if for whatever reason the greater Mississippi system could not trade with the rest of the world, that is the core of American power, capital generation, and agriculture and energy. So kind of a big deal.
So all of this shows that Cuba and you know, much of the Caribbean Sea are just vital to U.S. security. It's around half of America's total seaborne trade that passes through there. And as Zion said, these are really the arteries that the entire greater Mississippi system relies on to trade with the rest of the world. So a foreign power that controls the Caribbean and the sea gates there really could pose a serious threat to the U.S. economy. And that's really at the heart of why China is working with not just Cuba, but also Venezuela and Nicaragua and some others. China wants to be able to take over these ports and shipping lanes so that it can challenge U.S. dominance in the Caribbean. And this is something that Bible prophecy speaks about in quite a lot of detail. There are prophecies in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 that talk about a mart of nations or an economic alliance that will form between China and Russia and European nations. And if you study the names that are given in that passage, along with Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury's book called Isaiah's End Time Vision, then you see that those names are referring to modern China and European countries and Russia as well. And then Deuteronomy 28:52 shows that this economic alliance will actually besiege the United States. So Mr. Fleury, in his book there, he draws careful attention to the Latin American region as factoring into this besiegement, mostly just because of its proximity to the U.S. He writes, "We expect the alliance between Europe and South America to grow extremely strong." And then he explains that Europe already wields all kinds of influence in parts of Latin America. And he says that after Russia and China form a brief alliance with Europe, then the power that China is now building in places like Cuba will translate into even greater European control over that region, and it'll all be to America's detriment. So really, when we see China embedding itself in Cuba and other Latin American nations, we should see that this is just creating the conditions for that prophesied siege to take place.
So these sea gates, whether they're near the United States or on the other side of the world, are something to keep an eye on. We're going to talk about that in our panel discussion. A listener wrote in recently when we were talking about the sea gates and asked me this question in good faith. He said, "Do you really think that the U.S. Navy would allow a foreign power to blockade shipping through the Caribbean Sea or the Gulf of Mexico," which is what we're talking about right now? He said, "unless at that time we no longer have a Navy." So I thought that was a good question. We really appreciate feedback like that, where it's not only, we're hearing from you, but we're hearing specifically from you about what the issues are and what's being talked about. And I thought that was a really good question to ask. And what we're presenting on Trumpet Hour is not, just geopolitical analysis. If you need that, you should go somewhere else. What we're bringing you is what the Bible, what Bible prophecy says, and how events are moving in that direction. So I thought this was a really good question to ask. We're not saying that the United States Navy would just sit there and watch it happen, but as I responded, basically what I've learned, and I've said this before, is that we're always at war. There's always a struggle going on, and part of it's what the Navy's doing, part of its diplomacy, part of its electronic cyber attacks, part of its, there's a struggle going on constantly. And so if the Navy has the strength of the fuel of money and technology and diplomacy and leadership and ultimately the society from which its sailors come, it certainly would not allow that to happen. But if American society descends into infighting and the economy fails, and or enemies, foreign and domestic, destroy American conviction, then actual American infrastructure, or finance, or computer systems, then we can very truly, very quickly be in a situation where the United States Navy could not prevent something like this from happening. And Bible prophecy says that it won't be able to. So we're looking for how is that going to happen. And that's what makes Trumpet Hour unique, not our high-level connections or our millions of dollars of funding or our brilliance as analysts, but just the ability to provide what Bible prophecy says and to focus on that week to week. Mihailo Zekic, you have endured and overcome technology obstacles from there in our Jerusalem office for the purpose of giving us the main news headlines from the Middle East, where you are currently located. Give us the top stories.
Sure. Well, in one sense, it's been a bit of a slow week in the Middle East in that there hasn't been too many new 180 degree turns, explosive developments, but there have been plenty of explosions nonetheless, of old conflicts continuing to fester. And on Monday, Israel conducted an arrest raid in the city of Jenin in the West Bank. Jenin and its associated refugee camp are sometimes dubbed the hornet's nest by the Israelis for just how much it's infested with terrorists. And they went to go arrest some terrorists, and the Palestinians fired back at them. There was a clash killing five Palestinians and injuring over 90 others. There's been a bit of a reprisals in response the day after. There was a rampage by Jewish settlers in the West Bank against Arabs. There was also a terror attack against Israelis in another West Bank settlement called Eli. We're continuing to see, it's almost like it's old news because so many of these kinds of attacks and raids have been happening, but it just keeps getting worse and worse, spiraling more and more out of control, the relations between the Israelis and the Palestinians. That's something we will be watching. On Wednesday, a ceasefire, which wasn't really adhered to the best anyway, expired in Sudan. Our listeners may remember we had a panel discussion on the war in Sudan way back when. There's still fighting going on there between the government and the rapid support forces, the paramilitary group that used to be part of the government. At this point, it doesn't look certain who is going to come out on top, but whoever does, between the government and the rebels, there is going to be potentially significant power shifts, and it's a very much more unstable country in the Arab world. And also on Thursday, this is a story we haven't paid too much attention to, but it could have some interesting geopolitical ramifications. On Thursday, Ethiopia announced it's preparing to launch the fourth filling of its reservoir on the Blue Nile, controlled by the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Some of our listeners may be a little bit more familiar with this than others. Ethiopia is building a huge reservoir on the Nile using a dam, they say, for to generate electricity. Sudan, as we just talked about, and Egypt are very much concerned about this project. Egypt especially so, because they depend on the Nile River for their economy. Ethiopia has been going full steam ahead despite Egypt setting in a lot of protests. We'll see what kind of tensions simmer from that. We know from prophecies in Daniel 11 that we expect a lot more unrest to happen in places like Egypt and Ethiopia, and for outside actors to capitalize on that unrest. And this particular sticking point could potentially play a role in that.
So fighting in Israel and among the Palestinians, fighting in Sudan, and possible fighting as a result of that Ethiopia dam project. You've not mentioned, though, one of the most deadly powers in the Middle East, and that's who you're going to talk about for your main story?
Of course. That would be, many of our listeners could probably guess, the Islamic Republic of Iran. On June 21st, the Middle East Media and Research Institute released a composite report based off of various intelligence reports that certain European countries have produced about Iran trying to infiltrate these particular countries for its nuclear program. And all these reports are just within 2023 so far. The countries are the Netherlands, Sweden, and Germany. These aren't even collaborative reports. These are just individual reports that these countries have put together. And the Research Institute has conveniently put them into a package which It's their report that's sort of making the waves through the headlines this week. For the Netherlands and Sweden specifically, they've been focusing on Iran trying to infiltrate their university programs and their tech industries associated with those programs to smuggle in technology related with their nuclear program. They haven't specifically reached too many specifics as to which technologies, etc. For the Netherlands, for their part, but they did note that Russia has been helping out Iran in this case with whatever operation was going on for the little bits of information we can gather from there. And Germany as well announced that there's been some meddlings from Iran that way. Some of the what they've been saying on a state-by-state cases, like infiltration to Bavaria, etc., has been pretty vague. Again, obviously, there's a lot of sensitive work going into how they figure out what's happening and what was happening in the first place. So they're a little bit lip tight with announcing what was going on. But at least for the state of Schleswig-Holstein, there was at least one incident where a businessman was, or a local business was trying to do an illegal transaction with Iranian entities in sending in technology that could have been used for their nuclear and their missile program, specifically spectrometer systems and certain unspecified laboratory equipment. And the big reason this is on our news, again, in one sense, like there's no big explosion going on somewhere out there. There's no coup or regime change or anything like that. It's a little bit under the table. It's the tip of the iceberg. But at the same time, we cover on this program a lot about Europe and Iran coming to loggerheads with each other, and the nuclear program being a huge sticking point about that because of a prophecy in Daniel 11, verse 40 that talks about, we go to this prophecy over and over again, a king of the north, Catholic Europe, and a king of the south, Islamic Iran, clashing with each other. And you keep reading down through the prophecy, it eventually brings into World War III, a time that's so deadly if it weren't stopped, no flesh would be saved alive. Now, the reason this particular story is important is that we talked about this, the Iranian nuclear program last week, about America and Iran having dealings. That's usually the power people watch with in regards to a nuclear program with Iran, America. America was the one that put in the last nuclear deal. America is the one that has by far at this point the biggest and best ability to put a stop to Iran and its plans. Sometimes people will tie in Israel. They have a lot of dealings with it too. Europe has been a bit on the sidelines for this, for the most part. Yes, they were a party to the previous nuclear deal, but they weren't the driving force behind it, and they're certainly not the driving force at this point. They see Iran as a threat, but they also want to do business with Iran, and they don't want to get sucked into a war in the Middle East they don't want. But Iran is making it very, very hard for Europe to take this junior partner position as far as the West is going, with stories like this, with them infiltrating their own countries and trying to steal their technology to build a weapon that could potentially end the world. I mean, it doesn't get much more provocative than that. And we're going to see more and more pushes as time goes on. There's already been so many provocations like this, more and more provocations at Europe, until they, including and especially Germany, finally decide they have to do something about this. They can't let Iran keep taking advantage of them. They can't let Iran keep pulling the rug under the feet, so to speak. America's obviously not doing much. As we talked about in the last segment, Europe is going to have to step into its own role and fix it itself.
And you've pointed me to the Trumpet.com trends section. Again, the Trumpet.com, there's a section called Trends. And an article, Iran and Europe Heading for a Clash of Civilizations. This is a trend that we are watching. So even when Europe signs a nuclear deal with Iran, even when Europe jumps right in and buys billions, if I remember right, billions of euros worth of, or rather lets Iran buy billions of euros worth of aircraft and make other big deals, what we're looking for is not for a reconciliation, a peaceful coexistence, Iran fading away as a power, but for a clash of civilizations. And so read that, Iran and Europe Heading for a Clash of Civilizations, at thetrumpet.com, and see if it doesn't match what's happening now, and especially what's going to happen in the near term. So Mihailo Zekic, thanks for that report. So our next region we're going to look at is Europe. Richard Palmer, give us the top stories from Europe, if you would.
So the Chinese premier visited Europe on his first overseas trip. He traveled to France and to Germany. It's been an interesting trip. It's there have been clearly some tensions. There's been there's a push in Europe to make sure that they're not dependent on other countries for critical infrastructure. So, for example, Germany is spending billions paying Intel to build a new chip factory within Germany, this kind of thing. So this trip was very much focused on kind of preserving this this Chinese-European relationship, even while this process is going forward. There was, it's again interesting to see that this relationship was mostly driven by economics. There were a lot of business deals done here. German business leaders played a very prominent role during this visit. So we see this prophesied commercial relationship that we talk about a fair bit between Europe and China moving forwards, you know, tying into that siege that you were just talking about. Despite some of this push for Europe to make sure that they're self-reliant and not kind of vulnerable to blackmail from anybody. You had, talking of trade deals, there was a big deal that the EU signed with Kenya. This is something that has been many years in the making, and it's a significant step up in terms of Europe's presence in Africa. And so it'll be interesting to see how this relationship develops. But they're giving Kenya tariff-free access to the European Union, but it also gives Europe a lot of access to Kenya's economy. And then this is perhaps the news story that got me the most peeved this week from Europe. Spiegel had a news article where they it was pretty vitriolic about Donald Trump and about America in general. Basically, they said that if you live in the Midwest of America, you are a crazy guy with guns, and the world should be afraid of you. Spiegel got caught lying about rural America 5 years ago or so. It was a big deal. Their star columnist just completely made stuff up, wrote detailed accounts of towns he'd never even visited, this kind of thing. And then to see them coming up with something that was just so bizarrely off the wall. And then also, Germany puts great store in its kind of respecting the memory of the Holocaust. And we've got to preserve this memory. They at least pay lip service to this. We shouldn't trivialize this memory. And then to see Spiegel coming out and basically saying, transgender people in America now know what it feels like to be a Jew in 1930s Germany, is just abhorrent. It's false. It's a complete lie. It gives the impression that you're getting transgender teens being rounded up, put in trains, and sent to concentration camps across Texas. It's just absurd. But this is Spiegel. This is Europe's most widely read news magazine. They're regarded as gold standard credible journalism, and they will be believed by millions. And this is playing into this long-term trend of Europe really turning against America. And it's turning the hearts and minds of Europeans against, not just Donald Trump, but America in general.
When we look back at the history of the Holocaust and the history of World War II, and you're reading the history books, they're able to pick out these events that led up to the conflict, that led up to the bloodshed. I think history books in the future are going to point back to some of these exact things that you're highlighting here as the lead up to a great conflict and great bloodshed. I have not looked into the main story that you've notified me about, but the headline is really intriguing. Can you go ahead and give us that?
Headline, yeah. Nordic Air Force take flight. This is from Foreign Policy, but it's delving into a few recent developments where Sweden is on its way into joining NATO. Finland is joining NATO. So you have these Scandinavian countries. So we're looking basically at Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Denmark. And they already work very closely together. They've been divided, with some have been in NATO, some have been out of NATO, and that's limited how much they can work together. That division seems like it's on the way out. And once that's completely over, there's a very real plan for these countries to basically merge their air forces. And instead of having a Norwegian air force and a Finnish air force, you would just have a Nordic air force. So they would centralize the command of about 250 combat aircraft across these four different countries. They think that there's a lot of things that could work quite well together in terms of bringing these together. So a lot of their air forces are based around the F-35 fighter jet. So they can pool resources in this way. But then you've also got Sweden with their kind of home, their Gripen fighter jet, their domestically produced plane. And they're kind of saying, well, look, there are actually some advantages to having this solid F-35 fighter jet, but and also this Gripen plane that's much more unique. So that as foreign nations kind of design and tailor-make, you tailor-make your electronic countermeasures and your things that you're designed to intercept planes for things like the F-35, and then having like a more niche product also in your arsenal can help you avoid that kind of thing. And so they think that there's a lot that can make quite a powerful air force by this unit getting together. And they're looking at kind of moving forward on this. They're putting the groundwork in place, hoping that Sweden can join NATO this summer and they can really get going on this project after that.
Well, and isn't even just the principle of combining militaries? I mean, we went a long time, and as far as I can remember, without many headlines about nations combining national militaries. That's what caught my eye about this particular story.
Yeah, it is something that we've been forecasting for a long, long time, that you would have European power. I mean, W. Armstrong was talking about this in this after World War II, 1940s, 1950s, that Europe would come together as a military union. And he was very clear that it would be, that this would kind of be one of the hardest steps to accomplish. And so he talked about Europe coming together as an economic union, and then eventually as a political union, then as a military union. I think it reminds me a little bit of your question from that you read out, that sometimes the Bible says that this is going to happen. It's also clear that that's something that's not going to happen easily. And Mr. Armstrong saw that. This is where it's going to happen. It's not going to happen easily. Well, this is kind of what we can deduce about that. And so he forecast that you would have this political union first, or this economic union first, then political. And so he said this. It did take quite a long time to have some of this happening. There were important steps towards cooperation, even during the things like the 70s and the 80s, and the Anglo-Dutch Brigade, for example, that formed then, that has now led the way to this much more recent development, where the Dutch and the Germans have just, the Dutch have basically signed their entire army over to German command. And then on this heels, now you're seeing Scandinavia coming together and say, hey, we'll just have one air force. We'll share one air force. This really is seeming like an idea whose time has come, that there's a lot of nations now getting on board with this idea of let's pool a united military let's pool our resources, form this united military. You've got basically the Netherlands and Belgium kind of share a navy right now. There's all kinds of very interesting bits of naval cooperation going on between Germany and Poland. You've got Romania and the Czech Republic signing over significant chunks of their tanks to Germany. So this is really taking off in Europe. And that's a really specific prophecy in Revelation 17. It talks about 10 kings that are going to give their power to the beast. They're going to sign their military forces over to this supernatural authority. And we're seeing this happen with Scandinavia. We're seeing this happen all over the place. And we do have an article from Joshua Michels in our latest Trumpet print edition. It's called A European Army Already Exists, talking about the progress that has been made towards this. A lot of this has gone under the radar, but there's been a lot of movement towards this combined European military.
That was A European Army Already Exists at thetrumpet.com. If you haven't subscribed to The Trumpet, please do so. You can go to thetrumpet.com and subscribe. The magazine is completely free, as is all the other literature. Our next region to cover is Anglo-America. Andrew Miller, give us the top stories from Anglo-America.
Yeah, in Anglo-America this week, Britain's government is investigating allegations that UK universities are collaborating with Iran on drones and other sensitive technology. An unearthed email in the United States from former Center of Disease Control director reveals that she knew mRNA vaccines were dangerous, yet pushed them anyway. And the James O'Keefe Media Group published a secretly recorded conversation where a BlackRock recruiter described how the world's largest asset management firm runs the world by controlling politicians.
And I believe those were his exact words, runs the world. What's the big story to come out of Anglo-America?
Yeah, the big story coming out of Anglo-America is that we're still focusing on just the shocking allegations of America's two-tiered system of justice. Now, last week and the week before, we talked a bit about the indictment against Donald Trump. And just how, I mean, they're looking at like maximum penalties. They're not going to happen, but they're looking at maximum penalties of 100 years in prison for a violation of the Presidential Records Act. Now, obviously, many people have brought up the obvious point, and they're like, okay, well, that's kind of a, seems like that's going to be a misdemeanor at best. What about the 459 known violations of federal and state law we have contained on the Hunter Biden laptop? Now, Donald Trump almost prophetically came out and said that he thought Hunter Biden would probably get a slap on the wrist for those violations, just so that the deep state operatives can try to claim that they're being impartial in this case. And that's exactly what happened this week. They charged Hunter Biden with two misdemeanors in relation to unpaid taxes. And then they also charged him with one felony for possession of a gun after being convicted of as a drug user. So the message the deep state's trying to send America is that you can run an Eastern European prostitution ring if you want to, but don't you dare break our gun laws or avoid paying your taxes. That's a little bit of an oversimplification, because of those 459 known violations on the Hunter Biden laptop, 140 of them were business crimes, 191 of them were sex crimes, and 128 of them were drug crimes. So there's definitely much, 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 much more serious violations of the tax code that Hunter's not being charged with. We're getting some new reports out just in the past couple days that the initial IRS investigation into Hunter Biden was in relation to his activities with Eastern European prostitution rings, but he hasn't been charged for any of that. We actually got a revelation yesterday that he was some of his memberships in like some pretty vile sex clubs on the East Coast and other prostitution charges, he actually deducted from his taxes. So not even trying to hide it from the IRS. And then, of course, there's the, they just found $10 million in Biden family funds and a bank in the Mediterranean that was set up by Burisma. So it looks like we know of at least two $5 million bribes to the Biden family, one to Joe Biden, one of Hunter Biden, from corrupt Ukrainian oligarchs. And now it looks like we've got this new shell company that they use to launder that money through. But again, no charges on any of these serious offenses, just on these two minor misdemeanors and the one gun felony charge. And it looks like that's probably going to be all there is. The charge against Biden and the investment is ongoing, but I'll actually let
legal expert, Leo Terrell. We've got a clip from him explain why they say that investigation is ongoing.
Leo Terrell now, civil rights attorney, Fox News contributor. Great to see you. So you heard David Spunt say a couple of times that the agreement includes the words, it's not over yet, basically. They're still looking at, there's more to the investigation. What do you make of it?
Oh, Karis, you know what that's for? That's to block the House Republicans from getting documents. Just imagine if they would have said case is closed. They would have had no excuse, Department of Justice, from providing those documents to the House Republicans. Now that they say it's ongoing, we're still in an investigation. We got an investigation. So that provides a roadblock against the Republicans from subpoenaing those additional documents. And it's very shameful. This deal is a deal because Hunter Biden is the son of the president and he's a Democrat. It's a two-tier justice system.
So there you go. As you just heard in that clip right there, it's like basically the reason they say the investigation is ongoing is it keeps the documents in the hands of the deep state. As soon as they say the investigation's closed, Republicans in the Senate and in the House Judiciary Committee can request, like, oh, can we see the documents? And then they'll see all the documents relating to deducting prostitution costs from your taxes and bribery charges from Ukraine. They don't want Republicans to see that. So there's like, okay, said we're charging with two misdemeanors and a gun felony, and we're going to claim the investigation's ongoing so we never actually have to surrender any of these documents to the House Judiciary Committee or the House Oversight Committee ever.
I have looked at some of that information on that laptop, and it is reprehensible what that man has done, is almost certainly guilty of. But this, and people, I think, can get lost in the weeds of a court case in Arkansas and, you know, the this and that of the Justice Department and whether investigations are open or closed. But this issue involves everyone, doesn't it? I mean, this actually involves the nation, not just the reprehensible actions of one person.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's definitely a national security threat. Just, I mean, moral concerns aside for a moment, just the amount of blackmail that foreign nations have on the Biden family is a national security threat. And what might even be a worse national security threat than that is having a Justice Department and an FBI that are so concerned with covering up this blackmail and covering up this covering up just basically all this corruption and corrosion and whatever you want to call it is an enormous threat to America. Actually, the literature link we'll put in the show notes, I think, this week is an article titled The Greatest Threat to America's National Security by our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, that actually makes the case that, like, deep state infiltration of American intelligence agencies, the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, is a more profound threat to America than even, like, the Iran nuclear program or China taking over the South China Sea or Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because we can't deal with any of those other external threats because the nation's actually been hijacked from the inside. And it really does bring there's many prophecies we could focus on this week. We talk about 2 Kings 14 a lot, about the bitter affliction in America. We talk about Isaiah 1 a lot, about just the corruption from head to toe. But I would like to focus just a little bit at the end of the program here on Isaiah 10 and verse 6, where God says, I will send him against an hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath I will charge him to take the spoil and to take the prey. Where he is saying that, like, one of the primary sins he's so wrathful at end time America for is hypocrisy. And you can definitely see that with, like, this two-tiered standard of justice. You'll see that you've got the first Donald Trump indictment was for hush money paid to a pornographic actress. And even if there's no legal crime there, I mean, there's definitely some moral things in Donald Trump's past that he probably shouldn't be proud of, to say the least. But compared to what's on that laptop, and the fact that they're charging Donald Trump with, an order of magnitude more severely, several orders of magnitude more severely, actually. I mean, they're looking at maximum charges of 100 years in prison versus two tax misdemeanors. Just shows that the hypocrisy in America's justice system really is a nation-destroying problem.
As we said about the naval blockade, whether it's our military power, our diplomatic power, political power, economic power, it traces back to our individual behavior, our individual decisions, and the behaviors that we allow to infect and to spread. Stay with us. Welcome back, Trumpet Hour listeners. We focus your attention now on something the Trumpet usually calls Seagates. We've covered this a few times because it is an important issue. It's something that we often don't think about. But if you look around the room that you're sitting in right now, everything movable in there got there on a ship. Well, almost everything. Parts of things that you have in your office or in your room or perhaps even in your car, definitely in your car. At some point, at some phase of production, probably crossed the ocean at least once. So Seagates refers to the choke points, the areas of geography where ships must pass through. And having control of these Seagates is an important part of national power. And it's an important part of your personal life, because if those Seagates get shut down, get blocked, then your life will change. So the Seagates are back in the news this week, and Andrew Miller is going to give us the latest on that.
Yeah, China is calling on all nations to abandon colonial thinking, and specifically calling on Britain to hand over the Falkland Islands and give it to the nation of Argentina. Now, the Falkland Islands, it's a small island chain off the east coast of southern Argentina. And it's important in the fact that basically all trade, seaborne trade, that goes between the Atlantic and the Pacific, or the Pacific and the Atlantic, either has to go through the Panama Canal or around the southern end of South America. It's pretty difficult for ships to get up north of Canada. And those ships that go around the southern cone of South America, there's a naval base on the Falklands, to where it's not actually a sea gate like the Panama Canal, and that it's a narrow point of entrance and exit. But it's a place where you can project naval power to protect the sea gate that is the southern cone of South America. It's one of the reasons that Britain's held on to the Falklands for so long, and the main reason China wants them to give it back. They're going to pretend like they want them to give it back to abandon colonial thinking, when really it's a Chinese company that controls both ends of the Panama Canal. They'd like to be able to exercise more control over the southern cone of South America as well. Specifically, what happened this week is on Tuesday, June 20th, the Chinese ambassador to the United Nations, his name is Gang Shuang, accused the UK of playing power politics by keeping the Falklands, and made a comment at a UN meeting that he wanted all nations to abandon colonial thinking, and called again. It's probably not the first time for Britain to turn that back over to Argentina, which in reality means give China the opportunity to make deals with Argentina like they did with Panama, so they can start exercising more influence over those trade routes south of South America.
So this isn't an altruistic crusade by the Chinese?
Actually, yeah, I think that this is just rich, really. This statement made by China's ambassador to the UN, it's about as tone deaf and utterly hypocritical as anything you can imagine when you consider Tibet.
you know, this is a place that China, that does not want to be part of China. But China colonized it, and not in ancient times either, but just in 1949. And then there's also East Turkestan, which the Chinese call Xinjiang. There's Inner Mongolia, Hong Kong, and even the South China Sea, and all of China's threats to take over Taiwan by force. These are places that the Chinese Communist Party forcibly controls against the wishes of the people who live there. They often control these places violently and entirely against the principles of self-determination and, you know, the will of the people. Meanwhile, if you look at the Falklands, the people who live there vote overwhelmingly, something like 99.8% of them vote to stay part of Britain. They have zero interest in, or I guess you could say 0.02% interest in becoming part of Argentina. So this is more of China being China, you know, the ultimate hypocrite sermonizing to Britain about colonialism while it keeps its boot pressed firmly on the neck of so many people. China is, it's a dragon with a black heart, but there is really some logic to this because China is actually trying to woo Argentina a little bit with these kinds of statements because China hopes that the Argentines will soon let them build a naval base on their coast. That's at a place called Ushuaia, right at the very southern tip of Argentina, a place that's nicknamed the end of the world. And this would be really a place that would help China control who can sail around the southern tip of Latin America. And it would also function as a gateway to Antarctica, which China hopes to be able to harvest resources from.
Just to add to that hypocrisy point, I mean, to say it's colonialism for Britain to keep these islands and it needs to hand it over to Argentina, this descendant of a Spanish colony, is utterly preposterous. And then to do it at the United Nations, where Article 1 of the United Nations, you know, says the purpose of the United Nations is to develop friendly relations among nations based on a respect for principles of equal rights and self-determination. So if self-determination is one of the main founding principles of the UN, You can't give the Falklands back to they never owned it. You can't give the Falklands to Argentina. It's utterly contrary to the United Nations Charter. And I think it's, you know, this story I don't think got any traction at all really in the UK. It was just kind of, you know, typical Chinese nonsense that just kind of goes on in the background. But I think it does highlight the fact that there is this threat to the Falklands does highlight this continual story that you get in the UK, where every year or two we see more and more headlines about the design of the decline of the Royal Navy, cuts to the military. You know, we've got massive levels of borrowing. The government's looking at how do we bring that under control. They're continuing cutting back spending on the military, and it's a good reminder that there are military threats. You know, I think the idea of a British government voluntarily handing over the Falkland Islands, at least in the current political climate, I think it would be political suicide. Probably not just for that particular government or that particular prime minister, but probably for the party that would even do it. You know, Britain fought a war for this, for the Falklands, and there's no appetite to give it back among the general people. In that war, a lot of the people at the top of the Foreign Office, a lot of people even in government and the civil service, they were quite happy to let it go. They didn't see the point in fighting for a small handful of British people on an island. They didn't have much vision. Thankfully, the bulk of the nation felt differently. And so that's led to the situation where you are today. But you look at the cuts to the Royal Navy and you certainly have to ask the question, could Britain fight another Falklands War? You know, if you had, especially when you see Britain, maybe if they... You know, standing up to Taiwan or for Taiwan, or, you know, something happens in East Asia, China decides they're going to kind of push back by helping Argentina take the Falklands, and there's some other kind of surprise attack. Could Britain do what it did in the 1980s? And you look at the way the Royal Navy has been cut back. You look at what Britain did in the Falklands War. It was a colossal risk. Like, this could have gone horribly, horribly wrong. The nearest British, kind of the nearest military base that Britain was operating from, I think was like Mount St. Helens, you know, this remote place that that Napoleon was imprisoned in the middle of the Atlantic, thousands of miles away. You know, the Falkland Islands invasion could have been an absolute catastrophe so easily. Britain had the guts and the military capacity to retake that in the 80s, I don't think Britain would have, or was it the 70s? I should double check. But I don't think Britain has either of those today.
Well, we are 41 years on from that, and it's been 41 years of British naval decline. And then if you throw in what Jeremiah Jacques said there about China saying, all right, you keep the Falklands, we will build a base right near you in Argentina proper, that would be very hard to hold on to.
And then you even have to look at why China will be making these kinds of comments in the United Nations in the first place. I mean, you look at some other countries. At one point, the Turkish straits that go through Istanbul, they were international territory. Nobody would ask the Turkish government, like, you need to revert back to that. What, your control over this area is bad. The next thing that's going to happen is that country won't be able to sail through the Bosphorus. But with Britain, with countries that are descended from Israel that used to control all these sea gates because of the birthright promises in Genesis 12, promise to Abraham, et cetera, et cetera. These countries like China, they can see that the Israelite countries are declining, that they don't have the same appetite for war, for standing up for their territory, for standing up for their principles as it did even a few decades back. I mean, even the fact that Argentina took those islands in the first place. If Britain was in the state that it was during the height of the British Empire in 1900, there's no way Argentina would have even tried. As Mr. Palmer mentioned, it was a colossal risk. At this point, can you even say that it would be a risk? It would be an uphill battle, to say the very, very least. And you see countries like China moving into places like the Falklands and in other sea gates too, like they control at least have influence over the port of Darwin in northern Australia. There's been calls for Britain and America to decolonize the Chagos archipelago in the Indian Ocean, another one of these important maritime stopover places. So the fact that more and more countries are calling for, in their words, decolonization, the fact that they're bold enough to talk to these former superpowers to go ahead and let these countries go, I think just goes to show how far the Israelite countries, I should say, have fallen in respect in the international world, in respect for almost every other country, and especially every other world power out there.
I think Simon makes an interesting point, just bringing in what the Bible says about the decline of Israel and that these are the countries that the Bible prophesies are going down right now. Because you look at the attitude a lot of other countries have to their overseas colonies, they're not coming under attack in the same way. You can almost just, the whole prophecy of sea gates and then losing them, I mean, you can, that's massive evidence for fulfilled Bible prophecy. You have incredibly specific prophecies in the Bible saying these nations of Israel are going to get these sea gates and they're going to lose them. You see that happening. And then you look at these countries that are not Israel, China's gaining more sea gates, but nobody's talking about Spain to give up its enclaves in North Africa. France has huge numbers of islands all dotted across the world. I mean, they are Israelite, but they're also part of this European superpower. No one's talking about them giving them up. We had an article from Josue Michels up on the website this week talking about the way that Europe is kind of talking about empire, and empire being a wonderful thing, wanting to get back into empire. While it's only Britain and America that there's all this talk about empire as evil and dismantling empire. So, you have proof of Bible prophecy and the Bible just accurately foretelling all of these events in this subject.
So we'll need to continue to keep an eye on these sea gates, these strategic areas where shipping passes through. These are actually treated in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain Prophecy, that's been offered on this program. If you haven't read that, you can request it at thetrumpet.com/literature. The United States and Britain in Prophecy, again, for the general understanding on sea gates. And then more specifically, you can look at thetrumpet.com for an article by Andrew Miller titled Preparing to Storm America's Castle. Preparing to Storm America's Castle by Andrew Miller on thetrumpet.com. That's all the time we have for Trumpet Hour today. Email us your thoughts on the program, as the former sailor did, as we commented on earlier, to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Mihailo Zekic, and Richard Palmer. Thanks to Parker Campbell and Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'm Philip Nice, and that is your Week in Review for today's Trumpet Hour. Thank you for joining us.